session number 10044, reel 5.
Mr. Powell, reel 5.
I realised, after the loss of Cyrenaica, that a grave error had been made. A grave intellectual error had been made in the room where I was actually, where I was working. And from that moment onwards, though it was not interpretation of the ultra-material that had been at fault, I duplicated the whole of the work on the North African ports and campaign. I digested the entire ultra-material, as well as the entire photographic reconnaissance material, and understudied, therefore, in that sense of understudied, the work which my superior officer was doing. And I relate this as an illustration of what I said at an earlier stage about the regular army in the Second World War. For it must have been somewhere in April, March, perhaps, 1942, that I walked into the colonel's room and dropped into his in tray a photo reconnaissance survey in which I had identified all the vessels described only in the survey report, of course, by their length and position. It wasn't wrong before the bell rang. "I think you have this one wrong," said the colonel. So I argued my case and satisfied him that I had in fact correctly identified that ship too. "All the others are right," said he. "From now onwards, you will take over this work." Now, I think there's real greatness and real credit is due to an officer in those circumstances who realized what had been going on and then at that point said, "Well, all right, you take it over." And at that point, from that point onwards, I became the army member of an inter-service body at lieutenant colonel commander level. I was by then a major and was shortly afterwards promoted lieutenant colonel, which, on the basis of ultra and other material and appreciations, largely produced by the army, offered targeting advice to the Navy and to the RAF. And the manner in which the celebrated three albacores and the swordfish operating from Malta were utilized to do far more destruction of enemy shipping than they should have accounted for emanated from the discussions which took place before dawn in that inter-service committee. That was therefore the intensive work in which I found myself involved heart and soul. I was given an RAF lieutenant, flight lieutenant as a number two, in the spring of 1942. That was my work while the army was falling back to El Alamein. And at this stage, I was directly in contact with the DMI who had succeeded Shearer, namely de Gangon. And I was working to de Gangon direct in the appreciations which he was supplying to 8th Army and the General and the GOC as the situation deteriorated in North Africa. I remember the day when Mercer Matruh fell. I was actually in the room with him when the news came in that Mercer Matruh fell. "I reckon," said he, "there'll be rioting in the streets of Cairo tonight." There wasn't. The position held, the morale held in Egypt to an extent which certainly surprised those who were the certainly surprised the military command in Middle East.
Could I ask you about the what you observed of the attitude of the Egyptian population towards the British presence?
I did not, in the course of my duty, have occasion for direct relations with the Egyptian population or with their leading personalities. But I must say that I was surprised by the expectation that there would be trouble at that stage in Cairo. Certainly there was a degree of sullenness, and I think no one made the mistake of assuming that had the Germans taken over Egypt, the Egyptians would have staged a resistance movement against them. However, there undoubtedly was a marked contrast, which was based in history, between the relationship of the army in Egypt with the Egyptians and the relationship of the British in India with the population of that country. It is, as I say, based in history. England, after all, was always a temporarily occupying power in Egypt, and considerable bitterness and difficulty had attended the acceptance in the 1930s of Egyptian independence. It was perfectly visible to the naked eye, but as long as Britain needed Egypt and the Suez Canal for defense purposes, that independence would be severely qualified to an extent which was bound to be irksome to nationalists. In India, on the other hand, the presence of the British and the collaboration of a population in the formation and maintenance of the army was of long standing and was part of the fabric of the country, almost appeared one of the inevitabilities of nature. Jumping ahead to my days in India, I remember being constantly struck with the apparent inevitability which appeared to attach to the British rule and to the British presence. An Englishman, even in areas where the British were rarely seen, had rarely occasion to be seen, was treated, when he entered a village, more as a phenomenon of nature. As it were, that is the moon rising, that is the Englishman walking through the village, rather than as the intrusion of something which did not belong to the scene. On one occasion, I remember I was travelling by myself in North Bihar, and suddenly it occurred to me that I must be the only Englishman, indeed the only European, among several millions of a population in all directions, and yet my presence there seemed to be as accepted as it would have been if I had been travelling from London to Birmingham in my own country. So that although the end of British rule in India was, historically speaking, close, in 1943, 1944, and 1945, the sense of an imminent revolution was certainly absent from relations between the ordinary Englishman and the ordinary population.
What would be the reaction of Egyptians as you walk through their towns and villages?
I don't think it would have the same implication that, after all, the Englishman is part of Egypt. The Englishmen, the British, were part of British India. They were not something strange. They were not something artificial. They were not something which a conjuncture of political events like those in Egypt in the 1870s and 1880s had imposed. There was, therefore, a degree of acceptance and a kind of acceptance of the British and of the British army in India, which you could not expect to find in Egypt.
Did you ever personally come across hostility from Egyptians?
No, I can't say that I did. I think the word sullenness represents about the worst that one encountered, but one was conscious of a degree of jealousy regarding the presence of the British in India, particularly amongst officials, who would be naturally the people who would be in a position to feel and to exhibit it.
Presence in Egypt?
Yes. Well, it was shortly after the taking of Mercer Matruand as a direct consequence that there occurred the event which was jocularly described as the Great Fire of Cairo, when all the offices in the headquarters in Cairo were exhorted to destroy their papers as far as those could be dispensed with, on the assumption that they might imminently be falling into the hands of the enemy. The sky was dark with the smoke of the fires burning in the various courtyards, and dust fell heavily, rather like the dust on Pompeii, upon the houses and the streets beneath. This gave, I must say, a reality to the expectation of imminent German occupation, which it had hitherto lacked. And I remember that a brother officer of mine, a man who was my lifelong friend, who was in transportation at General Headquarters Cairo, and I formed a decision as to what we personally would do in the event of total collapse. And I do recall that we had our knapsacks packed with what we regarded as necessary to get us at any rate as far as Palestine and possibly Iraq. The problem obviously would be to get across the canal, but travelling light, we reckoned in the event of total collapse and catastrophe in Cairo, we should be able to do that. It may seem strange to say, to record today, that the idea which I personally had at the back of my mind was that if one could get to India, one could also get to China, and that China was likely to be the place of the ultimate resistance in the event of a sweeping German victory. China and Russia, in different ways, as the natural opponents of Germany and Japan, seemed to be the ultimate bastions in the event of the Middle East and the British position being totally lost. However, that's a bit of local colour associated with the Great Fire of Cairo.
At that time, was there any tendency of people to look for scapegoats?
I don't remember that in General Headquarters. Of course, it was shortly after this that the top commands were altered, and Auchinleck was replaced by Alexander, and that Montgomery was put in charge of the Eighth Army. But I don't recollect, I recollect a sense of relief that probably more coordination would be injected into the conduct of a campaign in North Africa. I think there was a sense that under Auchinleck, the local commanders had been given more initiative and that they had used it in a less coordinated manner than would have been desirable facing the German and Italian threat. And I think it was recognized that it was likely, and soon found that it was the fact, that that element of overall control would be supplied by Montgomery. It must have been somewhere around that time that I carried out for the General Headquarters Cairo a personal reconnaissance of the Katara Depression, the curious depressed area of salt marsh lying at the end of the southern, at the southern end of the line at El Alamein, to ascertain whether it was possible for the German armour to execute a flanking movement. And I had the experience of getting to know that very remarkable unit, the long-range desert group, which at that time was based at the oasis of Siwa, was certainly living in close and friendly relationship with the Senussi tribesmen of Siwa, and was exerting its mastery of desert travel in motor vehicles in order to maintain what I mentioned before, the standing surveillance of German routes. There was quite deep penetration for purposes of surveillance of the main roads in Cyrenaica and Tripolitania, with patrols sent out from and returning to and reporting from Siwa. Indeed, it was a small patrol of the long-range desert group that I myself took to the Katara Depression. We took with us a 3-ton lorry and experimented to see how far we could get with it. We didn't get very far, but as they were experts in digging, we didn't lose the 3-ton lorry. But at any rate, I was pretty satisfied that an outflanking attempt with armor across the depression would be likely to create more difficulties for the attackers than for the defenders.
Do you remember any of the individuals you went with from the LRDG?
I don't remember the individuals in the patrol. I remember the commander. He had just, I think, succeeded Prendergast. Of course, Prendergast had been the creator, Colonel Prendergast had been the creator in the last pre-war years of a long-range desert group, because he had made a hobby, and it was the results were recorded in a book which he wrote. He had made a study of the behavior of desert sand and the techniques of crossing moving sand with a military formation. And at the height of the German advance through Cyrenaica in the spring of 1942, the LRDG had in fact been withdrawn from Siwa to Kufra and crossed the hundreds of miles of a sand sea complete and successfully due south from Siwa across the moving sand. So their knowledge of the techniques of desert travel worked out in practice.
Was the initiator you referred to Prendergast or Bagnold?
Bagnold was the... you're quite right. It must have been Bagnold who was the originator in peacetime, and Prendergast who was his successor and who was the commander when I was there at the time. Thank you for reminding me. As soon as the line was more or less stabilised at Mersa Matru, a kind of routine established itself in the Inter-Service Target Committee, of which I was the Army member. And we certainly evolved an effective working relationship. I remember very clearly the RAF member, Wing Commander Long, who had been in Egypt before the war, work as the agent of a firm dealing in aircraft. He was particularly useful because he had relations with the United States, and the first American reinforcements were beginning to be available in Egypt, and it was important that our advice should be conveyed to them in a form which would make it likely to be accepted and yet would not betray the nature of the source, which was unknown even to the highest American commanders in the Middle East. And Bill Long, Wing Commander Bill Long, had formed a good personal relationship with the Americans, which enabled him very often to sell to them targets which they were reluctant to engage or go in search of, but which we knew from our sources were of particular importance. Then there was the naval member, a Commander Hubbock, with whom I used to exchange wages as to the situation which would be found at the harbours of Benghazi and Tripoli when those harbours were eventually re-entered by our forces. But certainly it worked extraordinarily well, because the potentialities of the arms, of a strike arm, were understood by the air and naval members of a committee. What I was contributing was an understanding of the German supply position from day to day and of its relationship to the battle in North Africa, and also a more detailed study of the implications of the ultra material in their bearing upon individual ships and the utility of one target compared with another. I remember one, I can't exactly date it, but I remember one incident, it must be from those months, when a particular ship was marked down on its return voyage from North Africa to the north side of the Mediterranean, and was in fact effectively engaged and sunk. It was, alas, only after that that we heard it was conveying 300 British prisoners of war. It had been the ship which had been important in the supply shuttle, and it was thought that it was worthwhile destroying it empty so as to prevent it from making further shuttle voyages. But that was the kind of tragedy to which one was indirectly and at long range exposed. In the summer of 1942, I began to double my work as Army member of the Inter-Service Target Committee, with work for Military Intelligence, MI1A, because Colonel Williams had become, when Colonel Williams became Montgomery's chief of staff, I succeeded him, Colonel Williams, as director of that part of military intelligence which was concerned with the study with the German army directly, direct military intelligence about the German army. So that I was doubling the enemy military intelligence role at GHQ for some 4 or 5 months, with my role as the army member, which I didn't terminate or hand over, the army member of the Inter-Service Committee. It was in that period, though rather later, rather towards the end of 1942, that I had a narrow escape from what might have been a humiliating episode in my career as an intelligence officer. The call sign, because of course low-grade intercepts were fed into the machine as much as along with the higher-grade intercepts. The call sign of Field Marshal Rommel, Roro, disappeared from the air for several days consecutively, and this was accompanied by the sort of rumour that can happen in war, that the Field Marshal had in fact been killed. And I prepared what I thought was a very just and detailed obituary of Field Marshal Rommel. I had it on my desk, ready for issue with the next intelligence summary, and for some reason or other decided that evening, which I remember very clearly, to put it into my in-tray for the time being. It was that evening that the call sign Roro reappeared on the air, and I was able to, I accordingly, with relief, tore up the obituary.
It was just instinct,
wasn't
it?
One shouldn't, negative evidence should never be treated on the same plane as positive evidence, so perhaps it might be argued that I was falling into a logical, the same type of logical fallacy as my own colonel had fallen into it, the disastrous misappreciation over the German armour in North Africa. It was immediately after the landing of Torch in November the 5th, was it not, 1942, that the whole perspective of a campaign in North Africa shifted, and it was foreseen that 8th Army would be cooperating in the Pinsir movement with 1st Army, and that in consequence it would be the central Mediterranean rather than the eastern Mediterranean, Tunisia and Tripolitania rather than Cyrenaica, that would be the vital supply areas for the enemy forces in North Africa. It was therefore decided by my superiors that my unit, that is the unit which supported my inter-service role, would be transferred from Cairo on loan to Allied Force Headquarters, And I remember doing a reconnaissance for the transfer in December 1942. There are some anecdotes which are perhaps have some flavor of the atmosphere into which the Americans were injected in 1942-43, which are attendant upon that reconnaissance trip. I flew over, perhaps incautiously, from Cairo to Algiers for the day. And having settled by late afternoon what seemed to me to be the essentials for the transfer a few weeks later, a fortnight later I think it was, of my unit and its accommodation in Allied Force Headquarters, Algiers, I found that I had missed the last plane back. The air chief, whose name for the moment escapes me, proved obdurate to my pleas that he might take me on as a passenger in his plane to Cairo, and some kind friend at the RAF, in the RAF at Algiers headquarters, said, "Why don't you go round the other side of the airfield? There's a squadron of American aircraft there on their way to Cairo." So I walked round the circumference of the airfield in Algiers, found the commander of the flight of 15 DC transport aircraft, explained my predicament, and was immediately welcomed on board. Apart from me, the flight was empty. It was heading for transport duties based on the Middle East. That night we spent in the desert due south of Algiers. The following morning, the first officer came back to where I was making the best of things in the fuselage and said to me, "Say, do you know where Castel Benito is?" So I said, "Well, I had an idea where Castel Benito is, but could I help?" So he said, "Yes, come forward." And I went forward, and by the grace of God, I was able to recognize sufficient of a road system in Tripolitania to bring the flight onto the Castel Benito airfield. We had lunch on the Castel Benito airfield, and the commander announced his intention of making El Agheila that night. I said, "But it will be dark before we get there." He said, "No, it's not, because we shall get there at 4 o'clock, or whatever the time might have been." And I found myself actually having to explain to him that you count so many minutes for each degree of latitude, east or west, plus or minus on the clock. "You don't say," was the response to this. And this was a flight of 15 aircraft in the blue, finding its way across to the Middle East, having presumably been brought over, I don't know, by ship on shipboard into Europe. We landed, the first aircraft in which I was, which was the commander's aircraft, landed in dusk. The others got down safely by following it precisely. "You were right," they said. "You were right about that." The next day was a half day's trip to Cairo from El Agheila. And once again I had a visit from the mate. "Same. There are three airfields shown on our map at Cairo. Which one should we come down at?" Well, I worked out that